Hello and welcome to another episode of Podcast DX, the show that brings you interviews with people just like you whose lives were forever changed by a medical diagnosis. Ron is not with us today.
I've heard he's doing cosplay in the Antarctic.
Maybe.
And I'm Jean Marie.
And I am Lita. Collectively, we're the hosts of Podcast DX. On today's show, we are talking once again about sepsis. If you remember, we talked a couple of months ago about sepsis with a woman from the West Coast. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Richard Brandon. And Richard is a sepsis survivor as well and the co-founder and chief scientific officer of Immune Express, a molecular diagnostics company that has developed a novel FDA and EU cleared rapid sepsis diagnosis test. We are really looking forward to hearing about this. Welcome to our show, Richard.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much for the invitation. It's very nice to talk to you, Lita and Jean-Marie. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Richard, could you explain a bit about systemic inflammatory response syndrome and its relation to sepsis?
Yeah, look, to answer that question, you really have to go back to the definitions of sepsis.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, sepsis definitions have changed over the years. I mean, it was recognized thousands of years ago as a condition, but in the 1980s, the first definition of sepsis came up for modern medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And then that changed to sepsis 2 in the 1980s and the 1990s. We're now up to sepsis 3 definition, which was introduced in 2015, 2016. But as part of the sepsis 2 definition, they introduced the term SIRS, systemic inflammatory response syndrome. So patients that met the sepsis 2 definition had SIRS plus an infection. So systemic inflammatory response syndrome is really a set of four clinical parameters that could be recognized by a clinician, including increased heart rate, increased respiratory rate, abnormal body temperature, and abnormal white cell counts. It's a way of recognizing whether somebody has a higher likelihood of sepsis, but the trouble is that there's lots of patients that have SIRS that don't necessarily have an infection, and those patients are equally ill, but they don't mm-hmm. have sepsis. And so you need to differentiate those two conditions so that the appropriate people can be treated for sepsis. And if it's not sepsis, you're still sick. So you need to treat that. So that's the relationship between SIRS and sepsis. I think that certainly the sepsis 3 definition has superseded the sepsis 2 definition, but there are a lot of clinicians in the United States in particular that are still using SIRS criteria to identify patients, and they're still using the sepsis 2 definition.
Okay. And Richard, what are the different stages of sepsis?
Yeah, I guess that also depends on the definition of sepsis that you're using, but mm-hmm. let's just go back to the sepsis 2 definition. That involved three stages, if you like, just sepsis, and then severe sepsis, and then septic shock. And so severe sepsis involves some sort of organ dysfunction, and septic shock really is a dysfunction of the cardiovascular system, and that's the most severe type of sepsis and very acute. I think that you could say that there were various stages, and you could say that one was more severe than the next, but when you talk about stages, it also, you tend to think that you progress through those stages,
mm-hmm.
But that's not necessarily the case. But yeah, so the latest definition, the sepsis 3 definition, would include only those patients that have organ dysfunction and or septic shock.
Okay.
Thank you. That's pretty detailed.
Mm-hmm.
Richard, what experience did you have with sepsis, and how did that influence your work?
Yeah, look, I've had sepsis multiple times. Again, it depends on what definition
whoa,
you use.
Whoa.
But, excuse me.
Wow. Okay.
And that's really as a result of my I've got an underlining or underlying autoimmune disease, lupus.
Okay. Okay.
And then I've had that for a long time, and yeah, that's the lupus when sort of attacking your own body, the immune systems, and you become more susceptible to infection. But not only as a result of the condition, but also as a result of the treatments, which are usually immunosuppressants. And so, yes, I've had lots of infections and sepsis. And certainly, I'm not sure whether it's necessarily influenced my work, but really, I think the main things that have influenced my work is my interest in immunology and an interest in infectious diseases. I think that certainly when I was an undergraduate, one of my lecturers said to me that immunology is the basis of all disease, and I sort of took that to heart, and that's I wanted to understand the pathophysiology of disease, so that's where my interest in immunology comes from.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's taken you the right path. And why is it vital?
Hopefully.
Why is it vital for healthcare providers to quickly and accurately determine whether a patient has sepsis or sepsis negative systemic inflammatory response syndrome?
Yeah, it comes back to what I said earlier. Really, is that all these patients are sick, and so they all need some sort of diagnosis, and they all need an appropriate treatment. So if you have SIRS and it's and you don't have an infection, some of the major conditions that it could be stroke or heart failure. So they obviously need a different type of treatment to somebody that actually has SIRS and an infection or sepsis. And so it's really identifying the right treatment for the right patient at the right time. So that's diagnosis is critically important there. But we also know that sepsis is an acute condition, and time is critical. Especially if you have septic shock. So it's been shown that if you have septic shock, then every hour of delay of appropriate treatment leads to an increase of mortality of around 8%. So it's critical that that people with sepsis are treated as quickly as possible. And in the United States in particular, they have measures in place, like for any hospital that gets funding from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, has to report their compliance to what's called SEP 1, which is a bundle of treatments or measures to manage patients with sepsis. And it's all of those are time based, 1 hour bundles and 3 hour bundles, and so. It's critical, to be able to differentiate those patients, but also time is important.
Thank you. Yes.
And Richard, how do you hope that your work with ImmunoExpress will aid healthcare providers in areas with limited healthcare resources, for example?
Yeah, it really comes back to what I said earlier, is the right treatment for the right patient at the right time. So I firmly believe that unless you have an accurate diagnosis, then you're not really treating properly. Certainly antibiotics are widely overused in hospitals, and I believe that at least one of the measures to help with managing patients with infections and with sepsis is to have a better diagnostic. So diagnostic stewardship leads to antibiotic stewardship, and this is where the ImmunoExpress technology fits in. Blood test quickly tells a clinician whether the likelihood of a patient having sepsis. And so at the moment, that test is relatively expensive, and I think that it's less likely to be used in low to middle income countries at this point. That doesn't preclude it from being used in the future, but even in high income countries where we're focusing at the moment, there's pretty broad disparity in the levels of treatment and diagnosis that patients get in hospitals. And when it comes to sepsis, I'd say that different hospitals would be able to provide different levels of care depending on skill levels of clinicians and their access to appropriate diagnostic tools. Not every hospital, for instance, has a CT scanner. And so certainly this test is really aimed at trying to even out those disparities across the healthcare system and different hospitals in high-income countries when it comes to sepsis diagnosis.
So what is the typical time period right now for across the United States, for instance, in order to get a sepsis diagnosis? If I went to the ER right now, what time frame would I expect to get a diagnosis?
Yeah, look, I mentioned the SEP 1 earlier, these measures that have been put in place by Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Really, there's a one-hour bundle and a three-hour bundle. And so the aim is to be able to give those bundles within those time frames.
But no. Okay.
No. And so the compliance to SEP 1 varies across different hospitals.
And that's just based on availability of equipment and tests?
But also skill levels of the clinicians.
Okay.
And so if you walked into a hospital at 2 a.m. in the morning and you don't get to see a clinician because they're not there, you're talking to an early graduate nurse, and they may not have the understanding of the urgency of sepsis or the requirements. So I guess that's what I'm saying. From my experience of sepsis, if you suspect you have sepsis, I would go to a large facility.
Okay.
That is more likely to have the skill levels and the equipment and the available resources to be able to recognize and treat you quickly.
And I think that's what we've seen in the past as well with guests who have survived sepsis, is that they went to they went to their local healthcare provider, and then they were immediately transferred to a higher level facility where they could get additional care.
Right. They had to take a flight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they were going from Hawaii to California.
To the mainland, right. Yeah.
So, wow.
And that's a long time, and
You lose a lot.
Yeah, it is. When you first present at small hospitals and then they keep transferring you, you're losing time. But you sort of, at the end of that process, you go, well, why didn't I go to a big hospital in the first place? Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm suggesting. Just go bypass all that and go to a big one.
If you can, sure.
Yeah, if you can, yeah.
Right. As we were researching this, I read a report in the World Health Organization saying that there were approximately 48.9 million cases of sepsis and 11 million sepsis-related deaths in 2017.
Was there a question in there?
No. Okay. I just thought that was shocking.
It is shocking.
And they also said that there were an estimated 2.9 million of those deaths were children under 5. And that crushed me. So I'm curious, Richard, what do you feel is the most misunderstood aspect of sepsis that might be feeding into that high number? You know, is it that people don't think it's serious? They don't go to the healthcare facility when they need to? What's the problem here?
Yeah, look, just to ram home the statistics that you mentioned earlier, look, sepsis is the biggest killer of children worldwide. That includes all of the low-income countries as well. So it's the biggest killer of children worldwide, and to me that's a tragedy. If you think about the number of deaths per year of sepsis, 11 million deaths per year, that's per year. That's more than the entire COVID pandemic killed across since we've had COVID. Mm-hmm. So sepsis is killing more people than COVID has every year. But really, I think sepsis is, to answer your question, is misunderstood at multiple levels. And I'm not sure whether misunderstood is necessarily the right word. I think education could be the solution. I think that the patients and the public need to understand the impacts of sepsis. They need to be aware of it and to be better educated so that they can act quickly and go to the big hospitals if they suspect they have sepsis. But I also think it's misunderstood at a clinician level. Having different definitions over time hasn't helped. But we regularly talk to clinicians that tell us that they don't need a diagnostic for sepsis. They can do it themselves. And then we talk to other clinicians that tell us that they don't necessarily are able to tell whether somebody has an infection or not. So I'm getting confusing messages from clinicians as to what it is that they need. And so to the clinicians that are telling us that you don't need a better diagnostic, I would point to the scientific literature that shows us that sepsis is a real problem. Mm-hmm. Diagnosis, better diagnostics are in need. I just lost my train of thought there, but I just think that clinicians just need better diagnostics for sepsis. But I also think that education that are at a higher level, not only for clinicians, but also for healthcare institutions and insurance and at government levels, because sepsis has a huge impact from a cost perspective also. At the moment, it's costing the U.S. healthcare system about $50 billion a year.
Okay.
Well, I was just going to ask, I didn't see a breakdown in those numbers as far as what countries are, you know, is the bulk of it in lower income countries and that's part of the problem?
Yeah, look, I think it is, especially sub-Saharan Africa. I think that with lots of children with malaria and HIV, sepsis is a huge problem. We are actually running a clinical trial in Uganda at the moment, and it just stuns me, and I shake my head when I read some of the clinical backgrounds of people in sub-Saharan Africa and the struggles that they have not only with endemic disease but also access to appropriate healthcare.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Yeah, but I guess in my opinion, the sooner you get a definitive diagnosis, that then you can, you know, you have your protocol for care and you can start implementing that right away. And the sooner you get that in place, the less likely you are to
be a snowball and take you with it.
Right.
Well, excuse me while I throw in an ad here to better serve our listening audience. We are an affiliate of a major medical supplier here in the United States, and you'll find affiliate links on our website, podcastdx.com. They aim to tailor specific medical supplies and equipment based on your diagnoses to make it less stressful than looking through an entire catalog for what you might need. We're open to your suggestions, and we will adjust our offerings based on what you, our listeners and guests, find helpful. But Richard, could you tell us more about the research and development that went into developing the Septicite rapid test? This is what I've been dying to talk to you since I heard about this.
Thanks for asking the question. I think it's a blood test. And it uses gene expression analysis in peripheral white blood cells to determine whether somebody has sepsis or not. And so in the early days, we had a lot of scientists telling us that it couldn't be done and it wouldn't work. So the first steps really were proof of concept, where we actually did some work in animal models to start with and did get proof of concept. So yeah, it works. You can use gene expression in peripheral blood to differentiate different conditions, not only sepsis, but lots of other diseases. But then we moved into the discovery phase. The discovery was, you know, we had to try and find particular genes or gene expression biomarkers that correlated to whether somebody had sepsis or not. So we started with very distinct and obvious patient diagnoses. So we had lots of patients that had definitely sepsis. that definitely had an infection, and we had lots of patients that definitely had SIRS or didn't have an infection. So, you know, we actually used patients that had just come out of surgery. So they had SIRS, but at that stage they didn't have an infection. So the idea was that you had two very clear, distinct populations, and then you're asking the question, can I differentiate these two? And the answer was yes. We discovered hundreds of biomarkers that were suitable. And then the next stage really is you need to make sure that those biomarkers are accurate. It's called validation. And so you do lots of different clinical trials and you test them out, and you end up choosing the best as a result of that, that are robust across different patient populations and different conditions and in different hospital sites. And so, you know, the biomarkers are specific to the condition that you're looking for, sepsis. And then the next step really is trying to get all of that through the regulatory authorities in Europe and the FDA, which is really a major challenge. Mm-hmm. And certainly they put us through our paces. And, you know, the US should be very proud of the FDA. It's an amazing institution full of very bright and very astute people, and they picked holes in what it is that we were doing, but nonetheless we're better off as a result of that process. So, you know, really a four-step process, but it's also taken a long time, you know, over a decade of work to get where we are today.
Wow. We would have no idea that that's how long it takes to get something from the thought
concept, right?
Right, to having something that works. That's wonderful. And the fact that you got the tenacity to stick to it until it's the end, because you knew that there was a goal in sight that you could reach. That's wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for developing this from the world. Thank you.
Hopefully we get there.
Yeah. With the COVID pandemic, many people found issues with supply chains for everything, you know, for diapers, for formula, for anything. Mm-hmm. Did the pandemic affect... Did the pandemic affect the rollout of the septicite rapid test?
Look, it did, yes, profoundly. And we put back maybe 2 years. Firstly, severe COVID really is a type of sepsis. But people didn't really recognise that viruses could cause sepsis. So we had to convince people that severe COVID was actually sepsis, including the FDA. But, you know, really, as you said, there were supply chain issues. And COVID tests, a lot of them are PCR-based or polymerase mm-hmm. chain reaction-based, and as is our test. And so we couldn't get our hands on any reagents related to PCR, mm-hmm. all the way from plastic laboratory wear to the enzymes that go into PCR to extraction kits that help us get the DNA and RNA out of tissues. So that was really problematic. But also, really, we were running clinical trials at the time, and a lot of hospitals were simply overwhelmed. They would tell us that, well, we have to stop this trial because we're focusing on COVID patients. But then when we tried to do COVID clinical trials, we were told that the hospitals weren't seeing any COVID patients. So it was a bit of a catch-22 there, is that we can't run your trials because we're overwhelmed with COVID, and we can't run your COVID trial because we're not seeing COVID patients. But and then we also had issues with the FDA, as I mentioned, not issues. They had initially a bit of trouble recognising that viruses could cause sepsis, and we didn't really get any emergency use authorization for our assay in for sepsis for severe COVID patients. But yes, so we you know, fairly profound effects of COVID on our development pathway.
Yeah, that's a shame. But again, you stuck to it, and here we are.
And Richard, getting back to you for a minute, with COVID and you're in living with lupus and you know everything else, how is it that you're able to maintain a good work-life balance, and what do you do to help counteract day-to-day stress in your work and your life?
We care about our people.
Well, thank you. Look, everyone wants to know the answer to that, I think. It's mm-hmm. difficult. And it's really, I think you could just really say, you know, diet, exercise, good sleep. But that's pretty easy to say, and then most people are aware of that. Look, I think that having lupus from a very early age and having lost my health so often, mm-hmm. you perhaps appreciate when you do have health, and you really do anything to hang on to that, to make sure you don't go into another lupus flare. And so it really, you try and do less work, to be honest. Mm-hmm. You got to say no to things. You say you just can't do things. And I think it also comes down to, for me, it's routine, fairly strict times that I work, and if it's not in those hours, then I'm not working. And you know, I work from home mostly, and I have an office, and I try to keep my work in that office rather than letting it spill into my day to day life. So
that's good.
Multiple measures, I guess, but mostly just trying to limit. I do work a 4-day week, at least I get paid for 4 days. But that helps too. I think that just back off a bit on the work, because really there are more important things.
And Richard, what is next on the horizon for Immuno Express? Or Immune Express, I'm sorry. I added an extra O in there.
We're trying to commercialise the test at the moment. So that's in Europe and the United States and also in Australia. So we've got to get through the regulatory process in Australia. Really trying to demonstrate clinical utility of the test so that more clinicians will take it up, so that ultimately the patients benefit. And so when I mean clinical utility, I mean benefits to patients, to the clinicians, to the hospital systems. And so we're trying to broaden its utility at the moment into, in particular, children and neonates, because mm-hmm. really young and old people tend to suffer from sepsis the most. We're trying to broaden its utility across the hospital. At the moment, we have it being used in intensive care systems. I'd like to see it being used more in specific patient populations, burns, trauma, maternal sepsis, people with cancer, they're on immunosuppressants, so they often get infections quite regularly. So in particular, patients that have what's called neutropenic fever. And of course, as part of our discovery process, I mentioned earlier that we had hundreds of biomarkers. So quite a few of those can also be used to differentiate the type of infection that you have. Bacterial, viral, what type of virus it is, what type of bacteria it is. And so there's still a long way to go with respect to using the biomarkers we have, but the first steps really are to commercialise it in the United States and demonstrate utility.
Okay, thank you. And Richard, what advice do you have for someone considering a career in science, or in particular working for a biotechnology company?
Yeah, look, I think science, as a science career, it can be pretty challenging, I think. And it's a long route. But I think science, mostly these days, the best outcomes and the best benefits come out of collaborative work. Really, you can't do anything by yourselves these days. You really need to work with other people. So I think it's important to, from my perspective and looking retrospectively at my career, the real fruit has come out of collaboration and working with other working with other people that have different skills to you that I do, but also surrounding yourself by very talented people. There's no way that Immune Express would be in the position it is today without the other fantastic co-founders that started Immune Express, but also the fantastic staff we have that are really dedicated to the science, but also dedicated to the company and all the skills that they bring. So collaboration would be a real one for me, for any career that you would undertake, but also really as a driver, really trying to ultimately benefit people. That's what drives you. If you're starting a biotech company, then and your main focus is to make money, that's really not going to work. You really have to have the underlying driver of trying to make a difference.
Mm-hmm. And I think we've seen that clearly demonstrated in the media lately. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we wrap this up, how can our healthcare providers, administrators, and procurement officials learn more about Septicite and the rapid test, and how can we learn more about you?
Yes, certainly. Immune Express has a website, immuneexpress.com. The Septicite Rapid has a website, septicite.com. And I'm on LinkedIn.
Okay.
I'm not on too many other social media platforms,
okay,
but LinkedIn.
That's
you should
right.
be able to find me.
That's one I'm just learning, so
yeah, you're learning.
I'll get
okay,
there eventually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then we'll include links on our website focused on this episode.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And thank you so much for joining us today, Richard. It was an honor to talk to you. I've really been looking forward to this really for weeks because this is cutting edge. I love it.
Well, thank you so much, Lita and Jean-Marie. I appreciate, again, the invitation, and it's been wonderful talking to you. Thank you so much.
If our listeners have any questions or comments about today's show, they can contact us at podcastdx@yahoo.com.
And if you have a moment to spare, please give us a review wherever you get your podcast.
And as always, please remember that this podcast is not I cannot talk either.
That's okay.
Intended
Jack's
to be a
Jack's got his work cut out
editing this one. This podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, and always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regime. And never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you heard on this podcast.
Till next week.